welcome to another episode of The Came to From the North, the only podcast done by Canadians discussing directors and their body of work. With me, as usual, we have from the far and mystical land of Newfoundland, Steve Power.
Are you sure we're the only Canadian podcast?
we're the entire population. What are you talking about? That's why we have to outsource to the States.
Well, we're the only good Canadian podcast.
Yeah, two shitty salesmen.
Also with us from Newfoundland, John Mercer.
Hey, how's it going?
And from the clean and dreary land of Ontario, we have Andrew Forbes.
Clean and dreary? Hello. That sounds like a burp. Well.
This week, we're going to discuss the work of Finnish filmmaker Reni Aalto.
Yeah, for anyone out there, when Gabe said Finnish, you got excited. Ooh, a foreign director, Reni Aalto.
Reni Aalto was born, I'll try to pronounce this right, Reni Lauri Moritz Arjola, anyways.
Reni Moritz Arjola. That's how I choose to pronounce it.
In Riihimäki, Finland. His parents were a nurse and a physician. He had an interest in film from a very early age. And apparently from the Wikipedia page that I'm reading right now, he became interested in doing movies when in 14 he saw Don Siegel and Charles Bronson in Helsinki filming the very famous movie Telephone.
Ooh.
Telephone?
Yeah.
Telephone with an F.
Telephone.
Oh, with okay, an F. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't remember a Don Siegel movie called Telephone.
It was the cast just sat in a circle and one guy would whisper to the other guy. It was kind of, the plot got away from them.
Purple monkey dish.
Aalto began his career by doing for commercials for big companies such as Shell Oil. Then he did a few movies as assistant cameraman and also cinematographer. In 1986, he did his first movie, Born American, which he did in Finland and gave him some attention in the U.S., where he was approached to do the horror movie Prison, starring then unknown Viggo Mortensen. That brought him to the attention of Robert Shea of New Line, who offered him to helm the fourth sequel of the Nightmare on Elm Street series, The Dream Master, which was a huge success. It cost,
emphasis on suck.
It cost $13 million and it made almost $50 million. So writing on that success, Arlen was offered to direct Alien 3 and did some work on there before quitting because of all the trouble on this Fable Trouble production. And then the studio offered him, the next day after he quit, he was offered to do The Adventures of Fort Verlaine, an action comedy starring Andrew Dice Clay. And when the executives signed the dailies, they offered to him Die Hard 2, which he would edit at the same time as he edited Fort Verlaine, and they came out about 2 weeks from each other. Fort Verlaine was a bomb, and Die Hard 2, of course, was a huge success. He followed it with another huge success, Cliffhanger, with Stallone in 1993. And then in 1995, he made one of what is known as the biggest bomb of all time, Cutthroat Island, which cost $98 million and only made $18 million at the box office.
And ensured that we would never see the Curl Co. logo again.
Yeah.
That was only the final nail.
Mm-hmm.
Terminator 2 actually had a lot to do with that, too.
that in 1996 he made the cult action movie The Longest Goodnight again with his then-wife Gina Davis and his not-then-wife Samuel L. Jackson.
Would have been interesting.
and without former wife Matthew Modine.
In 1999, he made the shark movie Deep Blue Sea. In 2001, he made the Stallone driving picture Driven. 2004, a movie about the FBI profiler called Mindhunters. In 2004, again, the fourth sequel to it, The Exorcist, The Beginning, which he, again, another troubled production, which Arlen was brought on to complete the movie after the studio had problems with Paul Schrader, like different.
He completely reshot it.
Yeah.
They are entirely different movies.
I think that there's like, what, 2 or 5 minutes of footage?
I think there's a little bit of overlap, and maybe a bit of the sort of scenery of some of the sets.
Some of the second unit stuff and stuff, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Then in 2006, he made the supernatural, teen movie, The Covenant. In 2007, Cleaner with Samuel L. Jackson, which was a direct-to-DVD film. In 2009, the movie 12 Rounds, starring wrestler John Cena. Yeah. And in 2001, he did a movie about the Georgian War, Georgia-Russia, that is, called 5 Days of War. That's and awesome. He has a movie right now in post-production, which doesn't even have a title yet. IMDb lists it as Untitled Rennie Arlen Project. and it's in post. So without further ado, let's get to our good with Mr. Arlen. Steve, what's your good for Rennie Arlen?
I've got a few that I really like. I got a few that I really kind of like. And there's a few that I really hate. My good, I kind of teetered between Die Hard 2 and Cutthroat Island for a little while, only because I'm insane. But I did wind up settling on what I think is... I can't possibly say there's anything else in his body of work that's better and more effectively made than this movie, and that is The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Yes.
Ooh!
It's, cracking Shane Black screenplay. You know, absolutely amazing Shane Black screenplay. I think probably the best thing Black was involved with since the original Lethal Weapon.
Best action screenwriter ever.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree. Me and myself and John have had this conversation several times. You know, we always wondered during the late 90s what the hell ever happened to Shane Black.
And somebody's going to find him in some monastery in
Tibet.
In Tibet and like show him a copy of Ballistic X versus Sever and be like, Shane, we need you.
and then he made the totally awesome Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
He did.
In 2005.
Yeah, and you know, like I think it was a great script. I think Gina Davis, I love Cutthroat Island because I love pirate movies. And my love of pirate movies predates this whole Disney Pirates of the Caribbean craze. And for me, like, seeing Cutthroat Island in theater was just such a joyful experience. I had so much fun with it. But Gina Davis and Matthew Modine, you know. So I kind of I had to go with Long Kiss Goodnight because it was definitely more well-suited to Gina Davis. I mean, you know, it really played up on her strengths as an actress a lot. And she was able to sell both personalities. You know, she could sell that whole dual split personality thing that was going on. She could sell both really, really well. And just the chemistry between the actors, you know, between her and Brian Cox and Samuel L. Jackson was awesome. It was just really, really, it was a crackling movie, man. And great action sequences, which is something that that Harlan does really, really well anyway, you know. And I just, overall, it's just a really enjoyable flick. You know, when it's over at the end of the movie, it leaves you with that really good feeling. You know, it's kind of like the original Lethal Weapon. You get that final sequence before the credits and... It leaves you with that nice, warm, fuzzy feeling. You know, it was an awesome action flick. It didn't pull any punches. You know, it was one of the last really old-school, hard-R, all-out action flicks that I can remember seeing come out of Hollywood before they started, you know, going into that whole self-aware, almost like over-the-top gore satire thing, or like the overuse of sex and violence, or the overuse of style. It was just more of a straight-up, you know, it belongs in the same book as, you know, Lethal Weapon, Die Hard, those, that sort of action filmmaking. And it was really the last of that style of film that I remember really seeing that played up on that style so well, you know, that classicist 80s action movie.
Mm-hmm. And there's that old thing about, I mean, the spy versus spy, which is kind of different.
Yeah.
Than those other, like when I was trying to talk about it to somebody who didn't know about it, I'm like it's basically the Bourne Identity before.
It did have that.
It's the Bourne Identity as an 80s action movie.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the character was great. The villains were, as far as Shane Black goes, probably the strongest villains he's ever written. Because let's just face it, as much as I love Shane Black, he doesn't write very good villains.
I like the villain in Last Boy Scout.
Last Boy Scout, again, you know, he was kind of weak. He was...
You know, there are some good moments in Last Boy Scout with the villain, who I like, and obviously I was sort of excessively praising Last Boy Scout, apparently, during our Tony's podcast.
Are we talking about the Texan or Milo?
Mr. Milo.
Milo.
If
and that's
ever
kind of the thing is...
Read the screenplay for it and see what he originally wrote for Milo, and it's like they'd never be able to put it on the screen.
Hmm.
Basically, John Waters with an assault rifle.
But no, it's, you know, I really like The Last Kiss Goodnight, and just so much dialogue, so much great stuff in that movie, and, you know,
Patrick Malahide is a scummy bastard, too. I love him. I think he was in Cutthroat Island as well.
Who?
He was in the whole wig and everything as
a
British naval guy, right? Yeah.
That's the guy who plays Perkins in Long Kiss Goodnight.
Yeah, Mr.
Mm-hmm.
What a scumbag.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, just, you know, this stuff, Brian Cox has some of the greatest lines ever in that movie, too. And he's so Brian Cox-ish in that movie, you know, like, whatever. Your dog, or you know, your dog has been licking its asshole for the last half hour. That stuff was awesome.
Gloria, please.
I submit that whatever is in there is either gone for good or there to stay.
And only Brian Cox could pull that stuff off. Right?
Yeah.
I found it on your notepad next to this crude drawing of a human phallus.
Well, I'm going to jump in here, too, because Long Kiss Goodnight is also my good. And because I wanted to, as long as we're talking about villains, oddly enough, I mean, I can understand why a lot of people do criticize the villain, but the Timothy character often comes in for a bit of
because he's
criticism.
He's awful.
No, he's great.
He can't sell it at all, man. They might as well have cast David Schwimmer.
I totally do not agree.
I think Schwimmer
whatsoever.
Might have been better.
No. I completely, like, honestly, I think if Craig Bierko were not known for the other roles that he's primarily known for.
The only other movie I know him from is The 13th Floor, so.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. Like, I honestly,
the first time I saw the movie, I thought it was Matthew Broderick.
I don't know.
So you said Tony Ferris.
No, I gotta give Black credit on that because he obviously saw into the future and created Dane Cook 10 years before Dane Cook, right? And like, you know, Timothy's got this whole douchiness about him.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just find
I don't know. I like
Bierko plays it too much as too much frat boy and too little sociopath.
Yeah. Mm. What were you thinking, Andrew?
Well, I was just going to say, like, he's that kind of blandly good-looking guy that you can see being the sort of, you know, Patrick Bateman if instead of a stockbroker he was a mercenary. It totally works for me. And he has that just
stuff,
sort of blank coldness.
I don't get any coldness from him. I get a guy who's really struggling with line readings. I get a guy, yeah, I've seen it too. It's called Baywatch Nights. Get to the fucking point. Like his delivery is just so flat and so bland.
For me, it would have been better if like him and David Morse had switched roles.
Yeah, yeah, and that would have made a lot more sense because Morse was just so. You know, Morse is just such a rugged cat, anyway. You know.
Yeah, but see, this was before The Rock. This is before everyone realized that David Morse was a badass.
I think David Morse would have been terrible in that role.
Like, you know who would have been awesome in that role?
Wayne.
Yep.
I've seen it too. It's called Baywatch Nights.
Get to the fucking point. No, no, it'd be less English Michael Wincott and more Metro Michael Wincott.
Not the cop who showed up at my door.
$10 million, Clarence.
I don't know.
Michael Wincott would have knocked that out of the park.
Like, I feel like that would have been overly showy. It would have been like, I'm a creepy villain. And I don't feel like that's what's called for at all in it, but whatever.
I do want to kill Birko when I watch the movie, so, you know.
Oh, but listen, one thing he does sell the shit out of, Long Kiss Goodnight's got one of the greatest villain deaths ever.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, it's elaborate, but not too elaborate. Like, it never steps into the whole Rube Goldberg insanity of Con Air. But it's just, you know, it's showy enough to be deserving of the movie's main villain. Yeah, mm-hmm. Just getting shot. I loved it.
I don't know. It seems to me when you've got lines like, oh, I'm hurt bad. I think I'm dying. Continue dying out. Like that's exactly the kind of thing he can read. Like that's.
Off of the cue cards.
No, it's. There's a, like, the flatness that he has feels like it's exactly what's called for. He's just, like, he's done with everything. Like, he's just, everything bores him. I don't get it as bad line reading at all, but whatever.
Yeah, I find he can't pull off that whole, that coldness. I find him really, really bland. I find him really dry.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
But that said, I mean, you know, he doesn't detract from the movie for me at all. I enjoy the movie immensely. And, I mean, that end with him, that die-screaming motherfucker, is just so immensely satisfying.
You also got to look at the fact that this is a man who's surrounded with Brian Cox, David Morse, and Patrick Malahide.
Yeah, there's also that.
And Gina Davis is scary good in this movie.
She is. She really is. And even then, like, you know, there are scenes with him that I do really like him in. Like, the scene where you first realize that he and Mr. Perkins are actually in cahoots, you know, where that scene where, you know, he answers the phone in the cabin or whatever, and then you see Timothy is overset to one side or whatever. Like, he's got a few cool scenes there where he actually manages to pull off kind of menacing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And more often than not, I just find he's too goofy. Yeah.
I'll say that... Long Kiss Goodnight is also my good. And reading the synopsis here, I just remembered this scene where it's a flashback and Charlie wakes up and she just stabs the guy. No, it's before she gets thrown out. She stabs the guy in the eye.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that.
Stabs him in the eye with a syringe or whatever.
Hmm.
I mean, there's that thing, too. Like, we've talked about the writing and everything, but in most of his movies, Arlen does have a great eye and a great feeling for action, and this movie looks really good.
Oh, like, the action is amazing.
And also, just the look of the film, I think it's Guillermo Navarro shot it.
Yeah.
So, like, it does look really, really good, and like, it's shot real well, and the pacing is amazing. Like, there's no dead air.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point where you're bored by it, and everything works. There's nothing like superfluous in it.
I also like how there's usually when you get these whole amnesia stories, there's like a 15-20 minute long setup before the movie starts rolling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Long Kiss Goodnight gets started after like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The opening, the narration, and I mean, you know, I've seen a few movies use that trick to really good effect. for some reason it always pops into my head immediately is Marvel's, like, the Daredevil, the Ben Affleck Daredevil. You know, they don't spend the whole movie setting up the introduction. They don't, it's not an origin story. You just get that opening narration where he tells you what's going on, and bam.
And then they jump straight to crap.
Yeah, well, you know, granted. But like, Longest Goodnight used it well, and a few other movies use it to really good effect, and I'm surprised it's a device that's not used a little more often.
Gina Davis had the charisma to actually pull it off, though.
Mm. Yeah, this is true. This is true.
And you know, there's some stuff like that scene where she's suddenly starts cutting the carrot like a mad girl.
I'm a chef!
And
which, chef. I have to say, that scene is guilty of severe saxophone abuse.
Yes. Yes, it is. Is it saxophone?
Are we talking like Roger Murtaugh saxophone abuse?
It's almost like ABC Friday Night sitcom clarinet or something.
It sounds like I'm listening to Baker Street.
It's like the soothing sounds of Daybreak saxophone.
Nice.
It's like the Baywatch intro.
And hey, Baywatch Nights.
But yeah, Dunk is Good Night. It's amazing. Watch it. There's some really great deaths. I still love that guy who gets strung up by the lights on the bridge. And yeah. That, like, then the Davis, like, cuts him up and starts shooting.
That was also a really cool trick.
As far as movies featuring giant explosions of bridges, River Kwai, nothing.
Yeah, nothing blowing up the bridge.
Actually, that was a record holder for a while, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Yeah.
What was it, the bridge between Michigan and Ontario or something?
Something like that.
And also the famous scene where they're jumping out of the window and she has time to shoot the ice.
Mm-hmm. That's because Gina Davis is so tall. Gravity affects her differently.
And the outfit she's wearing during it makes her look a little bit Mary Poppins-ish as she's falling there.
Well, yeah, it's pretty frumpy, man. It's probably a parachute effect. Also, the whole "you can't kill me, motherfucker" is still hilarious to this day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I busted a gut laughing at that in the theaters.
Yeah.
And also the what made me really laugh hard is like when they're at the farm and Jackson's there with the shotgun and he's like, "I got a shotgun, I'm a bad motherfucker." and then somebody, like, this guy just comes up behind him and puts
Brian
a knife.
Cox stuffs a gun under his jaw. I think that's a duck, not a dick.
It is, yeah, it is. Got a pistol in my pocket. Da, na, 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 na. Got a shotgun, too. Na, 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 na. Nobody wets with Mitch. Because he knows just what to do.
Because I'm a bad motherfucker.
I still love the alley. I still got this big fucking gun. Hey, this ain't exactly a ham on rye, pal.
The hell are you doing? Saving your ass. I've been here sooner, but I was thinking up that ham on rye line. I love when she boots him out of the van, boots him out of the car.
What do you need?
And he just lies.
And just lies in the street, smokes his back.
Yeah, that's a great scene.
So many great moments in that movie. Jackson really gets a lot of gold in that movie.
Yeah. Although I do have to say, I do really cringe at the end when her daughter is, like, talking her back into, like, consciousness.
Life is pain.
It's just the whole echo of the scene on the pond.
Yeah.
You know, it's to be expected. When you bring kids into movies, they generally cheese up the joint.
I know. But this was, like, I don't know.
Get up,
was
mommy!
Was it the girl from the remake of Miracle on 34th Street?
I think it is. I think it is.
Quite possibly.
Anyway, John, right. Did you have another good to talk about?
I did. Because I love Long Kiss Goodnight. But fuck you guys, I'm going with Die Hard 2.
Woo!
No!
A movie... No, Andrew, just let me be for a couple of minutes. I honestly feel that Die Hard 2 doesn't get the respect it deserves as a sequel to one of the most beloved action movies of all time.
And I actually agree with you there.
I do too. We've had this conversation.
Let's just face fact, I will call Die Hard the greatest action movie of all time. In my opinion, it is.
Okay.
I wouldn't argue with that.
No, it definitely belongs. It's definitely top tier, and it definitely belongs in the top five of any list of action movies.
Agreed.
The first Die Hard is, to this day, fucking amazing.
See our award-winning John McTiernan cast for more information.
Yes.
Yes. Die Hard 2 manages to, you know, pretty much, because basically it's the exact same story again, right?
Hmm.
But it pulls it off without falling into any pitfalls. It's an immensely satisfying action movie. I will, to this day, or to the day I die, argue that it's the last
same
time
day, actually
with the last time we saw John McClane.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
You know, this is John McClane to me isn't a character who drives a car off of a ramp and steers it into a helicopter. John McClane is, you know, he was supposed to be the everyman.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the title of the film is the series is called Die Hard. It's not called Dead and Resurrected. You know, like Die Hard with a Vengeance and Live Free or Die Hard, he's beaten down and he's dead already, you know? And it just...
Can I just take this opportunity to say the title Live Free or Die Hard makes no sense?
Oh, it was shit. What's the new one called?
It's like Live
a
Free.
A good Day to Die Hard.
See, that's horrible too.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw... what was the movie we saw? Skyfall a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I walked past and saw the poster, Yippee-ki-yay, Mother Russia. That guaranteed two things to me. One, that movie is going to be terrible. Two, I will be there opening night.
Pretty much agreed on both counts.
Yeah.
No, Die Hard 2 is just it's just proof positive of those, the late 80s, early 90s action movie scene. It's just a crowd-pleasing, huge blockbuster thriller.
Die Hard 2 to Die Hard 1 is what Lethal Weapon 2 was to Lethal Weapon 1. It was the same characters back for another go-around, you know? Like, it progressed the characters from the first movie. It didn't feel like a separate random story. It felt like a later event that picked up where the first one left off.
Creepy Mel Gibson xenophobia.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, it was...
It bulletproofed itself against... Because, I mean, they make the joke in the movie, how does the same thing happen to the same guy twice?
How does the same shit happen to the same guy twice?
And it's brought up by a couple characters, you know. They mention seeing him on TV.
One thing
Colonel Stewart says, I think you were out of your league on Dateline.
Yeah.
Well, the most incredible thing is having original Val Johnson pop up again.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, there's a great line that he has when Bruce Willis says, oh, you know, it's just one of those feelings.
Ouch.
So, when you have feelings, insurance companies start... What is it?
Insurance companies start going bankrupt.
And it's just... I really, really liked it. You know, a lot of people complain about the villain. And, I mean, yes, I'll say that Colonel Stewart's a little bit bland in comparison to Hans Gruber.
He was menacing,
but he's also different.
He was
come on, it's William fucking Sadler. Don't badmouth William Sadler.
I'm not gonna
badmouth
a man. That's why it's my good.
But I like how you had the turns and stuff in it. You know, like I liked the stuff with Franco Nero, and I like the turn at the end of it and stuff. Like there was just so much good shit in that movie. And Franz's airport security guy, like it was a great collection of characters, man.
Yeah, and that is something that I can't say it was missing in With a Vengeance. It was definitely missing in Live Free or Die Hard.
Oh my God, yeah.
Right, and I mean,
and even though they let him run around a bit more, it maintained a sense of claustrophobia.
Yeah.
And also, like behind every locked door in every airport you've ever visited, apparently is like a labyrinthine steam.
I love, too, that, like, you know, they upped the stakes a little bit, you know? Like, Die Hard 1, it was like, yeah, okay, he was trying to rescue his wife, he was trying to save these people in a building. But, like, I really like the crisis in Die Hard 2. I love the thought of all these planes just circling and running out of fuel. You know, like it's something, and, like, to be so powerless, like, it really upped the stakes a lot, you know?
And I think it was also really ballsy for them to in the movie for them to actually crash one of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right?
It's okay. It was British Airways. But
the pilot honestly, was Chief O'Brien, so that makes everything better.
I'm kind of ambivalent about the up stakes in Die Hard 2 because what I find is that you sort of like it's a neat scenario, but at the same time, I almost feel like it lowers the emotional impact somehow by having it, you know, in the first Die Hard, it seemed like, you know, if people were killed, it was going to be face to face and personal and, you know, people that we'd spent some time with. And in Die Hard 2, it kind of just felt like more of an abstract concept of there are lots of people. It sort of tends to veer into that area of, you know, one person is a tragedy, a million people is a statistic.
I don't think it does. I think it feels more. I mean, picture or remember how shocked you were on 9/11. You know, like when
you know, okay, let me be clear.
You know,
these are the opinions of Steve Power, and they do not.
But no, just think about that. I'm not comparing it, but. It does still have, to me, it does still have the emotional weight because it is, you know, like it is a greater tragedy. It is a, you know, it's not 30 people at a house party. It's, or at a work Christmas party. It's, you know,
400 people on a 747.
Yeah. Like I look back at even the Arrow era in Gander back in 1982. I mean, I was alive for all of that. And, you know, I was old enough to remember how much of a big deal was made about that. And I mean, that was like a crew of American servicemen. It was like up until 9/11, it was the highest body count of any aerial tragedy in existence. And there was a huge deal made about it. It was like people were shocked. And I mean, we didn't know anybody, you know?
And again, not saying that planes crashing and hundreds of people dying is not as tragic. What I'm saying is in the context of an action movie, I feel the suspense less when it's, you know, we have 20 planes in the air versus, you know, the pregnant lady and Takagi and...
Andrew, if he failed to stop those terrorists, the plane crash would have killed his wife and Dick Thornburg.
That's right.
Well,
and
I know that.
And the cute old lady with the taser.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
She shocked her little dog. Poor thing lived for a week.
Had me wishing the plane crash.
I think the emotional core was still there myself. I really do.
And I mean, you still feel the suspense for McClane, at least, you know?
Yeah.
Yes, you do. And I'm not saying there's no suspense. What I'm saying is that I feel it was, in an odd way, kind of reduced. There's a sort of immediacy to Die Hard that doesn't really get replicated with Die Hard 2, I find.
I respectfully disagree there.
But
I definitely respectfully disagree. And to me, it feels like there's more of a, like, Die Hard 1, it's just, you know, it's him trying to survive, and it's a great film. I love it. But Die Hard 2, I really felt it was more of a race against time. Like, everything had a more of a sense of urgency to me in Die Hard 2.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the cool twists. You get, you know, like, the scene after the church when McClane goes back to the airport security and finally gets Carmine on his side and stuff like that, you know, like... A lot of those scenes were freaking awesome, man. Were just so good, you know, like really, really well done stuff. And
it's also got some real quality kills in it too. The icicle to the eye, the guy getting smashed underneath the roller in the luggage.
Yeah, I still remember. Right? Like, I still remember the first time I watched Die Hard 2, when he walks into the airport security, like their bullpen or whatever it is, and shoves Carmine against the wall, and then opens up at him with the MP5. I still remember. You know, how awesome I thought it was when he pulls the clip out and runs up, blanks, that's what they were using out there today, you know, and you realize what's going on. And, like, that to me was just such an awesome moment, you know?
And it's kind of amazing when you look at Arlen's previous movies and the budget he had to work with, and then he's ended this big property with a lot of stuff going on and a huge budget. And he managed to put all of this and make it work.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it's kind of considered the redheaded stepchild of the series, and I think that's total bullshit. I think it's the best movie next to the first one.
Oh,
especially
yeah.
in a series that contains Live Free or Die Hard.
Yeah, really.
I agree that it's second next to the original.
Yeah, it, the comparison to Lethal Weapon definitely holds.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there are a few things that grate on me, especially some of the supporting actors / characters. Art Evans just drives me crazy in his movie. You want to talk about people who can't read lines? Oh. Like.
The Black Elmer Fudd.
Seriously. And, you know, Dennis Franz is a good actor. I like Dennis Franz. I cringe whenever a Carmine scene in this movie.
I love this. Yeah,
especially
that
terrible, terrible line, what sets off the metal detectors first?
The lead in your ass or the shit in your brains?
Shit doesn't set off metal detectors.
Yes, but Bruce Willis, like Kurt Russell, can take a line that's absolute crap and make it work.
Mm.
That line to me holds the same amount of weight as "Give my regards to King Tut, asshole." And that's what I miss from John McClane. You know, the guy who's his witty retorts are in the fist fight. I had Die Hard 2 on the other night. When he's fighting Colonel Stewart at the end of the movie on the wing of the 747.
Yeah.
You want to talk about stakes being raised? He calls him motherfucking motherfucker.
See, that I love. Like, I love. There's like a wit in the idiocy of that. Like, that's great. I love that. The metal detector line, it's just like. It's so smug and like, oh, I'm so clever. Yeah, but it's like,
Bruce
no.
Willis.
No.
That's Bruce Willis in every freaking movie he's ever acted in has been smug and clever. It's the exact same effect in the scene in the first I heard where he's on the stairwell with Hans.
Glass?
You know?
Who gives a shit about Glass?
I'm not the one who just got butt-fucked on national TV, Dwayne.
That's great. Oh.
I love Die Hard.
I'll tell you, one background character does drive me insane, and it is the reporter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sarah Plain and Tall should have never been allowed in front of the camera.
Good Lord.
I can't believe that woman was a reporter.
Ugh.
Is this the chick who runs into him in the elevator or whatever?
Yes, the talking nose that he runs into.
I didn't find it. And I like the whole, like, I mean, she's only in it for, what, 3 seconds, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It had been a while that I'd seen it, and I completely forgot that John Leguizamo was in this.
He doesn't even
get a line, he's dubbed over.
And Robert Patrick gets one of the
best movies
ever.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, no, and there's testament to Harlan as an action director, the scene on the Anakin Skywalker.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Really good.
And I'd forgotten Harlan loved squibs that much.
Oh, yeah.
I watched 3 of his movies in the past few days, and they are bloody as fuck.
Yeah, this is like Paul Verhoeven squibbing.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. It's like RoboCop squibs, where you're getting, like, you know, an inch of cloth blast off their back, followed by a big eruption of spaghetti sauce.
And usually, you know, whenever it's slow motion, it's like the one single globule. Like zero gravity Klingon blood. Just kind of goes.
Yeah, like when Robert Patrick buys it on the Anakin Skywalker and you get the shot of his back exploding. Because McClane, like, shoots him 8 times, right?
Because
one bullet's never enough.
No.
And I still.
To hell with that. The movie's called Die Hard.
I still love that. What do I look like to you? A sitting duck.
And actually, Fox used to use that on one of their DVD demo reels all the time.
Yeah.
That shot of him when he does sitting duck and lifts the gun up into frame.
Yeah.
I always loved that shot.
Die Hard 2. Andrew, I mean, we've heard some of your recommendations. Do you want to get into your bad now? Just to remind people that
my bad is Die Hard 2.
And he's wrong. Like, he was wrong with Black Rain.
Oh, great. Give it up. I'd like to point out that I'm not the one in this podcast who is ready to say that Cutthroat Island was their good.
I didn't say Cutthroat Island was my good.
I know, but I'm just saying.
You're saying what?
Getting all this heat.
Cutthroat Island's amazing.
Cutthroat Island. It's a pirate movie.
Because you are so shallow and
Frank Langella, Frank Langella negates that line. Step back on board, Harry. I'm gonna split you wide open.
Die Hard 2. I like it quite a bit. There's just the fact that it doesn't have quite the same sort of claustrophobic, you know, I feel like John McClane was a little bit more vulnerable. And I mean, it's not really a fault of Die Hard 2. It's more the fact that Die Hard is so perfectly constructed. But it just, every time I watch it, I can't help but compare it to the first. And it tends to be a little unfavorable.
The scale hurts it a bit.
The scale hurts it a bit. You know, William Sadler, he's a great actor, but I feel that he was given really, I mean, there was so much personality in Hans Gruber.
Yeah, but see, you can't fault Die Hard 2 for Hans Gruber.
Yeah.
You really can't. I mean, no. You know, you're talking about...
I'm using it to illustrate the failing of Die Hard 2. You know, it's not that it rises to the level of great villain, but not super great like Die Hard. It's that William Sadler is kind of a non-entity. And he's it's not merely that his motives are sort of unknown. It's just... Yeah,
he,
I know.
He paid good money to rescue a drug lord.
And I think I like it kind of sticks to the Die Hard principle of that. In the end, it's all about the money.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. You know, he can say all the lines he wants about men who have the guts to stand up to communist aggression. But in the end, it's all about drug money.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, also some scenes that are sort of a little bit too colorful villain and, like, it feels like he's trying too hard. There's a scene where he, you know, he doesn't tolerate failure. And he puts the gun up to his, like, henchman's head and pulls the trigger. And it's empty. And it's just, it feels so contrived in a sense that, like, they're trying so hard to up the scale of the original that it distracts me. So
I think that's you not, failing, that it's, not Die Hard 2's failing. You're just too cynical.
I love that scene. I love the damage is minimal. The penalty, on the other hand, is severe.
All right. Well, put on.
You fail me again, that chamber won't be empty.
All right, John, what's your bad?
Oh, I got a treat for you guys.
Uh-oh.
Watched this one last night again. This movie comes up fairly often in my action movie queue. And as a child, I loved it. And to be honest with you, I still love it. But there's just so much weakness on screen that I can't help but ridicule it. So, of course, I'd have to be talking about Cliffhanger. I remember Cliffhanger being a huge deal when it came out. You know, it was kind of a career or an early career renaissance for Stallone. Following the epic failure of Rocky V.
It made even more money than Die Hard 2.
Yeah. I mean, you're looking at, I think Cliffhanger made near $300 million.
Cliffhanger
which in 1990,
was immense.
In 1993, that's a lot of dinero right there. And, yeah, I can still remember. That was one you couldn't escape in the entertainment news. Right? Cliffhanger was a major, major, major hit.
I mean, they marketed the shit out of it, too, though. I mean, before it released, they
I love the trailer with the opera music in it.
Yeah. We were there opening night. We saw it in theater opening night.
That would probably have been better than the score.
Oh my god, the score! I'll get to that now in a second. But yeah, I can remember going and seeing that one in theater at 11 years old. I can remember I loved the poster. I wanted to get the poster and take it home. If I remember the poster they had in theater was just the one that had in huge letters "Hang On."
Yeah.
Right, and the silhouette of Stallone jumping.
jumping from one cliff to the other with a rope hanging behind him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just, you know, the movie was, it felt like concentrated badass. And I just remembered it so fondly in my head. You know, I loved the, Rex Lane is a guilty pleasure of mine. The guy who plays the Treasury agent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, I always remembered hating the villains in Cliffhanger. You know, couldn't wait till Stallone got his hands on them. And then going back to it, I realized the reason I hated the villains so much is because they're just goddamn awful.
They all,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what makes it even sadder is that with better casting, they could have been awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I posted on my Facebook wall the other night, watching Cliffhanger, I can't decide what's hammier, John Lithgow or The Score. And Lithgow is terrible.
Oh, yeah.
Terrible. And this is a guy who has played a psychopath before in a movie and been pretty damn good. I think Lithgow played the villain in Blowout.
He did.
Yeah.
Early Brian De Palma film, was really good in it. He played the villain in a early 90s Denzel Washington movie called Ricochet.
Yeah.
Again, just playing a psychopath and was pretty damn good at it. For some reason, in Cliffhanger, he decided he wanted to play it with a British accent.
You Brazilian bastard.
And it's a horrible British accent.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sitting there watching it going, man, if they had had some, like, any, even a lower-ranked British actor at the time, you know, Charles Dance or Stuart Wilson, that would have been a thousand times better.
I can't buy for a second that Lithgow could stand toe-to-toe for more than 3 seconds on the side of a crashed helicopter in a fist fight with Sylvester Stallone. That scene was such bullshit, man.
Make what jokes you want about Stallone's height. He was still, like, this was still at the point where he was, like, 0.02% body fat.
Yeah.
You know, the man was Italian Adonis.
And Stallone was good in it. Stallone did a great job.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But even Rooker's pretty bad in this flick.
He is. He is.
What hurts Rooker in it, man, is just the whole contrived...
You let my girlfriend die thing.
Yeah.
That stuff is just handled so piss poorly.
Yeah.
Right, you know, you're looking at that and going, like, in any real-world situation, Rooker would be the one who would be busted out of the... out of that job for eternity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, who brings a beginner on that tower? They even reference that, but... Still.
What was Al doing on the tower with a girl who could barely climb?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a great, Cliffhanger's a great looking movie. You got all these monster shots. Harlan directs the shit out of the action in it. Even, you know, I heard some complaints or shots in it that look like they're on a soundstage. And there are.
Quite a few.
You know, in particular, I always remember the shot of the guy going over the, it's when Stallone's having the fight with the guy. He puts the torch up in front of the night vision glasses, and they kind of do the slide down the hill.
Yeah.
And dude, of course, falls into the abyss. And when the shot of him going over the cliff and Stallone kind of doing the rollover flip when he hooks the pickaxe into the side of the mountain, holds on. And it's like, it looks like it's shot on a harbor front. Like there's this, you know, it's supposed to be moonlight, but it looks like there's this bright searchlight shining off of one side of the screen. But, I mean, even that doesn't really bother me. What bothers me is John Lithgow and the British Elvis Stoiko-looking guy who gets an awesome villain death.
Oh, yeah. Season's over, asshole.
Kills the shit out of him. Leon, I think was the actor's name, plays Kinnett, the knife-happy guy, and the one Stallone kills down in the cave.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's terrible. It amazes me in this day and age when a man will put money before the personal safety of himself and his bitch. Yeah, just the villains outside of Rex Lynn were terrible. And that really, really, really damages Cliffhanger. A lot of the writing was pretty bad, too.
Oh, yeah. There's those...
Some of the lines are really, really cheesy.
There's those hippies that serve no purpose except to get killed.
Yeah, it's kind of like artificially upping the stakes.
And the scene with the bunny rabbit with the tracking device.
Yeah. And there's some points, especially near the third act, where, I didn't quite get how they got into that cave. There seemed to be something missing, you know, a link, like.
Yeah.
This is called hitting the next chapter button on your remote, not realizing it.
Or maybe I just fell asleep for some weird reason.
I don't hate cliffhanger. I don't mind cliffhanger, but I will say that right from the first time I saw it, right from the original night we saw it in theater, we walked out and everybody was like, "Oh, that was amazing! Oh, it was awesome!" I was kind of like, "Yeah, it was okay." You know, it's a movie that I really took to.
It's a movie that I keep thinking I want to own. And I'll go back to watch it. I'll rent it and realize, I'll remember all the great parts.
Yeah.
And I rewatch it and realize how much horrible stuff is in there.
Yeah. And it's one of those movies, I've owned it, I think maybe since DVD, I had it on VHS back in the day, but I think since DVD, I've owned it maybe 3 or 4 times. And it's always one of those things that the first time I bought it, it was on, a $14 spinner rack back when $14 spinner racks were holy crap. And,
then it was a $9 spinner rack.
Well, no, since then it was usually I'd be at work and we used to always do the 3 for $15 deal. Or 3 for $10 deal, sorry, on used DVDs. And it was always I need a third. Oh, well, yeah, maybe I'll get cliffhanger again. And I think there was 2 or 3 times I bought it like that, and just never really, I never did really bother with it a whole lot. I think I might have watched it twice in the last 10 years.
And that's just it, for a movie that made $300 million, it's pretty forgettable.
Oh yeah, and man, that score is so pompous and doesn't fit the movie at all.
Oh, I know what they were trying to do with it. It was all about sort of majesty and huge mountains, and just musically, I really like the score, but
doesn't match the scenes.
It doesn't. No. Yeah, exactly.
The scene with the two hippies, the two surfer guys. Oh. Running away from Kinnett when he opened fire with the Uzi, and you got Michael Rooker running, screaming in slow motion silence, and then one of them takes 8 bullets in the back again, just like he gets the Robert Patrick exit, and the score at that point is terrible.
Mm-hmm. But no saxophones.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that you wonder what people loved about it so much, because it's fairly forgettable.
And still love
The action is really well directed.
A lot of people still love that movie.
Oh, yeah, it's really well made.
It's like all of the technical aspects of it are really good.
For a movie that's got that much great action and some of the stunts in Cliffhanger are mind-blowing, it looks great, but for something like that to just be so forgettable,
It's the terrible villains, the terrible writing.
You said it yourself, Forbes, a couple of days ago. Lithgow sinks it.
Yeah. Right?
The writing, it starts taking on water, and then as soon as Lithgow opens his mouth.
Walker!
Tucker and Walker, we're missing 3 briefcases.
Of course, I just like that Stallone's character was called Gabe, because that doesn't happen often. I notice it.
It was Kurt Russell in Tango and Cash as well.
Yeah.
And you're batting pretty well in the action movies.
Yeah, try finding an Andrew.
I think Time Cop's name was Gabe, too. No, that was Max.
The score was Trevor Jones. That explains
everything. Yeah, Trevor Jones. All right, Steve.
Check out Long Kiss Goodnight instead. That's got an Alan Silvestri score.
Oh, yeah. Steve, what's your bad?
My bad. If there was a bad, it would have to be Cutthroat Island. I love Cutthroat Island. I love Cutthroat Island because there's lots of swashbuckling and sword fighting and ships with cannons shooting at each other.
And that movie is
great action sequences, the two ships at sea firing at the horse and carriage as it races through a waterfront. That stuff is awesome. Absolutely.
How much daring do is on screen in that?
So much daring do. So much. And it's got every...
You want daring do? I got daring do.
That's right. Oh, I got some daring do right there. But it's such a great, like...
Buckles are swashed.
Oh, yeah. There's lots of standing on tables with hands on hips going, ha-ha! You know? But it's...
And hey, Rex Lynn. Unrecognizable with, like, 100 facial tattoos. Who am I kidding? He's still recognizable.
He is still recognizable. Mr. Bowen, wasn't it?
The Quartermaster.
The Quartermaster, yeah. And Mr. Bowen was the kid, I think.
With his great big braided goatee.
Yeah. I mean, it was an awesome movie. It was, like, lots of great action and stuff. But then we get to the one flaw, the one thing that keeps it from being my good. And it is the most horrible, terrible flaw that a film could have. The leads were awful.
Mm-hmm.
Gina Davis mm-hmm. and Matthew Modine were fucking terrible in this movie.
And Gina Davis should have been awesome.
She should have, yeah. But she was too...
She's too perky.
Yeah, she was too happy-go-lucky and too...
I think the main problem is she had to keep reading that, what do you call them, script?
Yeah. You know? And I think the idea of, you know, Gina Davis as a pirate captain, and I think even to her, it was just so girly... You know, have fun with it and just run with it kind of thing. Like, I mean, I know she didn't put any effort in there, but I bet she was having a ball making it. I bet she half making it. But, you know, it was just...
She should have watched Robin Hood 100 times before she started filming, though.
Yeah. You know... She
should have watched Captain Blood.
Yeah, there we go. Which is amazing.
That's a pirate movie.
But there is something that's a bit wrong, I think, in the tone of the movie. Like, it's a bit too funny and winking at the audience a bit too much.
But that's a perfect movie.
You know what? I think, honestly, they were trying for that 30s, 40s Errol Flynn vibe.
Exactly.
But they don't have writers that can pull it off, and they don't have a cast that acts in that style.
And there was too much 90s in it. There was too much of that 90s action feel and stuff in there, you know? Too much Rennie Harlan in there.
And the running time is a bit overblown, too. It could use some cutting.
Yeah. But just Matthew Modine sucked so bad. And Gina Davis was better than Matthew Modine, but she still wasn't great. But then, of course, you've got the supporting cast, which was pretty good. And then you've got Frank Langella, who just totally owns it.
Mm-hmm.
He is so goddamn menacing in that movie, man.
Well, you're talking about Skeletor.
Yeah, well, he's even better at this than he was in Masters, though. He's just, he looks absolutely huge in the movie. You know, he looks...
That sword, man. He's the serrated sock rapier.
You know?
Mm.
And that voice of his, you know? And the first scene you see him in, you know, when they're leaving Tortuga or whatever, wherever it is they are, and, you know, we haven't taken on supplies. We need less mouths. Bang! You know, it's just crap!
I love each time he has a line that refers to the fact that he's her uncle, and he says "come to uncle" or stuff like that.
Yeah, he's just so menacing, man. He's amazing.
I remember when you were a little brat bouncing on my knee.
Yeah.
Come to your uncle Douglas.
And then, of course, you get that really like he had an awesome death scene, but you get that cheesy one-liner.
Oh, that's a really bad one-liner.
Bad dog.
You know what? Now that I'm looking at IMDb, I never realized it before, but his name is spelled like Rapper Dog.
Yeah.
D-A-W-G.
D-A-W-G. Dog Shaw.
I think that's more of a whole thing that pirates couldn't spell.
No, I just, like, I find it funny that it was like, I always assumed it was like D-O-double-G. I don't know.
I like, there's so much of that movie I enjoy, and I will say it. I mean, I really think that at least a little bit of Cutthroat Island's DNA did end up in Pirates of the Caribbean. Like, they have kind of a similar feel.
And that, especially that treasure in the middle of the lake there near the end.
Yeah. I really think that they did kind of borrow a little from each other. You know, well, more pirates definitely did kind of, you know, borrow a little from Cutthroat, which definitely borrowed from the classic pirate movies. But, I mean, how long had it been since Hollywood had made a real pirate movie?
The early 80s.
And another fly I want to add to it is whoever plays Captain Trotter.
Trotter!
Angus Wright.
It was awesome.
Oh, man, the scene when Langella starts imitating that guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It's definitely an underrated movie.
I think so.
But yeah, it's got some major, major problems.
As I was saying on Facebook, it's basically like Waterworld.
Yeah.
I don't know. I find Waterworld, I can kind of watch and just like, I just like the whole vibe of it. And even when it's cheesy, it's kind of an enjoyable cheesy. There are moments in Cutthroat where it just
makes you cringe.
You can, yeah, exactly. You can tell the writers are just trying so hard.
But still, it's a movie that didn't deserve to be such a flop.
No, it definitely didn't. And the joy is all up on screen. You know, there's never a point where Cutthroat Island feels like it's phoning it in. There's never a point in that movie where it feels like, you know, it's Hollywood by committee, blockbuster by It always feels like they're being earnest. They're really trying to make just a fun pirate movie, you know?
And talking about fun, I'll segue you into my bad, and that is The Adventures of Ford Fairlane.
Your pronunciation of Fairlane is awesome. If I was like ever had the money to buy a classic car, I'd buy it. I would buy it in that accent.
The Ford Fairlane.
I'm looking for a 1954 Ford Fairlane.
It's a movie that like I have no excuse to have liked and enjoyed as much as I did. It's just so ridiculous.
Everyone's got one, Gabe. Man, it's your DC cab.
Hey, DC cab is way better than Ford Fairlane.
Yes, it is.
Steve Power and Sanity Clause in play.
DC Cab was not just an Andrew Dice Clay vehicle.
Yes.
DC Cab did not have a trailer that just consisted of Andrew Dice Clay stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean...
Set to Billy Idol.
Yeah.
The stuff I really like the look and the silliness and all the ridiculous plot developments and Robert Englund as a hitman and
Australian hitman.
When Newton makes a great villain.
That's a sentence you don't often get the chance to say.
No, but
see,
really...
now there was a perfectly English sentence.
All the words, I know all the words.
I thought I really liked him. I thought he made it work.
He did. I agree with you. And I really enjoy the movie. But
I own it.
It's goofy as hell. It is really as hell.
And I
put Ford Fairlane for me ends up in the same boat as stuff like The Last Dragon.
Yeah.
You know, I've got no reason to love this movie, but I do.
I mean, there's a koala in this movie, for God's sake. How can you not love it? And there's also Gilbert Gottfried getting killed on air.
There is that.
But still, you have to survive the Gilbert Gottfried being alive period.
And I have to say, I have the same problem with Ford Fairlane that I kind of have with Cutthroat Island, only amplified by 10. Andrew Dice Clay needs to get hit by a truck and die.
Oh. Has anyone ever tried harder to be cool?
There we go.
I wanted you
the bit you had wrote earlier the night on. You know, there's trying to look cool, there's really trying to look cool, trying too hard, and then there's Andrew Dice Clay.
Yeah.
But I mean, he still. I thought he did commend the attitude and the look, though, like.
Of total asshole. Yes.
Yeah.
Listen, if there was ever going to be an Andrew Dice Clay vehicle, it had to be Ford Fairlane.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problem is
with the first part of that, if there ever had to be.
Everybody in that movie thinks he's an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
I think even Ford thinks of himself as an asshole.
He made a career.
Which is one thing that I don't think he has in common with Andrew Dice Clay.
And there's some great lines. My favorite is something like, talking to her was like masturbating with a cheese grater. kind of exciting, but mostly painful.
Sorry I didn't call you. I was up all night eating Swedish meatballs. Holy shit, Morris Day was in this movie.
But yeah, it's a fun B movie, but there's no reason like I have no excuse for liking it, and it's totally misogynistic, and it makes no sense.
There's one way to guarantee me to sit down and watch a movie, and that is, in the plot synopsis, if you see the phrase, insert actor name is a private detective.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty much, yeah, I'm there.
Yeah, but you see, most of the time you get that, and the insert actor name is Paul Newman.
Paul Newman.
Really, Andrew Dice Clay was just like the Humphrey Bogart of 1990, right?
Oh, we all know this. We know this to be true.
Oh.
He made a career out of inserting coarse language into children's nursery rhymes. That alone tells me just how classy this guy is.
To hell with Julia Roberts, my movie's going to be huge.
And apparently, of course, the Razzies gave it, like, worst actor and worst picture and worst screenplay and all stuff like that.
And for once, they were right.
Oh, my God, the score was by Yellow.
Yep. But, I mean, Arlen still gives it a great look.
He does. He does. And, you know, like, what action is in there is actually pretty well shot and stuff.
For me, this is Rennie Harlan as Beverly Hills Cop 2 is to Tony Scott. It's like, it looks great, but...
So, are you saying I'm a bad person for liking this movie? And...
Yes, you're a terrible person.
We're,
and you know what Andrew Dice Clay would say about you, Gabe? You're French and you're Canadian.
All right, onto our uglies, which is our worst films for Rennie Harlan. And there are a few to choose from.
Oh, yeah.
So who wants to go first?
I'll go.
Go.
I was a bit quiet during Cliffhanger. So, yeah, Mindhunters.
Oh.
Now, I'm not going to say it's worse than The Covenant, which I was tempted to choose, but I watched Mindhunters more recently, and I paid to watch it.
Oh, Andrew.
So that made it more painful.
Oh, no.
Could someone explain why Johnny Lee Miller was ever considered for a lead role? Oh, right, Trainspotting. He wasn't absolutely horrible in. This is... I don't even know where to begin with this. The premise is, you know, you've got this sort of unrealistic CSI type group of
going on a field trip to a scary Scooby-Doo island.
Exactly.
It's the Breakfast Club of CSIs.
I love Christian Slater's exit from the movie.
It's amazing. I will give that to Mindhunters. Spoiler alert for anyone. They actually do pull off kind of a psycho moment in that I really didn't expect Christian Slater to suddenly just freeze like the T-1000 and break into three pieces.
Well, I mean, I thought he was going to be the lead actor, you know? I really thought he was going to be the lead of the movie.
But Arlen specializes in those, like Samuel Jackson biting it in Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah.
I think he was trying to recreate that here, and... I do
the,
not.
The difference being that Deep Blue Sea is amazing, and Mindhunters is shit.
I'm not a big fan of Deep Blue Sea, but yeah, it's way better than Mindhunters. So we've got Clifton Collins Jr. as like the most irritating
Clifton Collins character. Jr. he's ever been.
Yeah, and that's saying something. Val Kilmer does his usual, comes in for a few lines, then picks up a paycheck. Johnny Lee Miller.
Was Kilmer up to Marlon Brando levels at this point?
He was, yeah. This was kind of when Kilmer.
He was puffy.
Yeah, this was when it started to kind of descend into that whole cameos and.
Yeah, this was more when it kind of looked like he was just.
So,
you know,
how did he get so svelte for Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
That was the same year, right?
Makeup.
Yeah, so he wasn't huge.
He just looked puffy. Like it. Like he'd just been stung like a bee.
Eating a piece of cake, and I'm guessing that wasn't in the script.
I cry at the end of Real Genius whenever they show Val Kilmer scarfing down the popcorn, because I know where it leads.
Oh, it's just like the most trite kind of like twist movie. With, like, everything's incredibly obvious. you know, none of the clues are worth paying attention to because they're all just, it's basically entirely comprised of red herrings.
Yeah.
Just to keep you guessing.
I'm the killer. Why? Because you never expected it.
But I did expect it. Shut up.
You never thought we'd be stupid enough to go that route.
Yeah, it's all the characters are profilers, so they're always like being clever and profiling each other, and it's just agonizing. Johnny Lee Miller does the worst Southern accent I've ever heard in my life.
Patrick Swayze in Next of Kin?
Yes.
On IMDb, Isaacs in Black Hawk Down? On IMDb,
Black Hawk Down was amazing.
Jason Isaacs, at least, you know, Jason Isaacs goes cartoonish.
Jason Isaacs had seen Cliffhanger, and this was England's vengeance.
Johnny Lee Miller goes cartoonish, but tries to underplay it, if that makes sense. I don't even know how he does it. It's just so terrible.
It's like Jean Reno's Elvis impersonation.
I just saw something that can explain a lot. Eren Kruger did some work on the screenplay.
Yes, that was a lot. Also, of course, there's a moment where someone says, the killer's profiling us. I get that count number of times.
What was that in the trailer?
What?
I said, was that in the trailer? Probably.
No, I didn't watch the trailer. Yeah, Mindhunters, not good. Don't waste your time.
I wasted my time back in 2005.
I remember, one thing I remember about Mindhunters, actually, there was a pretty big deal being made about it before it came out. It was one of
the people were excited that it was a new Rennie Harlan movie.
Yeah, I remember like a fairly decent amount of hype, like especially on like, you know, the usual suspects, all the internet joints like Dark Horizons and Ain't It Cool and all this, and you know, talking about this.
Oh, I love whenever you break out Dark Horizons.
Val Kilmer and Christian Slater were at the height of their popularity.
Yeah. But no, there was a fairly big deal made about it, and then of course the rumblings started coming out from pre-screenings that it was actually terrible, and then it vanished and wound up, I think, going direct to video for most. You know.
Hey, you know what? There's something I do have to say about it before we go. I have to give Christian Slater props, especially for this period in his career. There's a shot in this that is clearly actually Christian Slater, where he has a really muscular butt. Way to bring that butt up to spec for Mindhunters. That's commitment.
Holy shit, guys. Slater's ass is in better shape than it was in Cuffs.
Wasn't this like Alone in the Dark era Slater?
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
Oh, my God.
Okay, wants to go next.
Ugly. You know what? I don't even remember what I had for an ugly.
I'll go next and let you think. Go check the Facebook because you said what
it was. Tracks, the TV movie.
Tracks.
I got excited when I saw that. I was like, oh my God, he directed that crappy Shadow Stevens movie from the early... No- oh, 2000. And- never mind. My bad, and this is coming from someone who, you know, loves big action spectacle. I don't think there's enough words to describe how much I hated 12 Rounds.
And I have just high hopes for that, too, you know?
Well, I thought it was... I'm not going to say, you know, I had high hopes. I'm not going to say I watched The Marine and it really wasn't that bad, because it was pretty terrible. But
it was.
You know, you saw the poster of it from the director of Die Hard and the producer of Speed. I was like, okay, they're actually taking this shit seriously now. Man, Cena got himself in shape for this movie. He's got
Cena looks like they took the skin off of a pig's face and then put a cinder block in it.
I'm sorry, that's the funniest thing I've ever heard. That's almost as good as Willem Dafoe looks like they took Dennis Leary's face and stretched it over Dave Navarro's head.
I live, please.
It's so bad. I mean, basically the whole concept of the movie is John Cena is a cop in Nolens. And one night he and his partner pull over Peter Baelish from Game of Thrones. and Peter Baelish's stupid stripper girlfriend gets hit by a car, and Peter Baelish turns out to be a criminal mastermind, and exactly 1 year later breaks out and decides to make John Cena's life a living hell. Which, you know, if this movie had come out in 1993 and starred somebody else, it probably could have been a fairly tight little action thriller. But it's absolute garbage. And I still have to give Harlan credit, because working on a budget of $20 million, it's not a bad-looking movie.
No.
But it's just, you know, his standards were so low. You know, you're watching, it's like, this is the guy directed Die Hard 2? Cliffhanger and Long Kiss Goodnight and Cutthroat Island?
Was there even one icicle in it?
No, there wasn't.
There's a good... I like the tramway stuff.
Yeah, there's a couple action sequences that are decent, but I mean, it's just... All the actors in it are terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to rag on Cena. Cena's a pro wrestler, okay? Everything he says in it sounds like it's coming off of a teleprompter.
They got me hostage. It's my wife.
It's my wife.
But you know what? You can't just say he's a wrestler, because you know what? The Rock's pretty good. There's some wrestlers that actually have charisma.
Yeah.
And
well, I mean, you got The Rock, who is all charisma.
And you know what? I got to say it. Ted DiBiase Jr. was actually pretty badass in The Marine, too.
No, actually, I'll side with him on that. For a direct-to-DVD shithouse movie... this guy actually knew what he was in and played it up a little bit.
Yeah, he did a great job. The movie itself was crap, yeah, but he was pretty good in it.
And I'm reading here on the Wikipedia page, am I pronouncing it right? Aidan Gillen?
Yep.
Prior to him being cast as Miles Jackson, Al Pacino, Joaquin Phoenix, Kevin Bacon, and Sean Bean were all considered.
Yeah, no, considered but turned down.
Considered in the fact that people were like, you know who would be great?
I think it's considered to the fact that one of the producers, like, don't even send them a script. Just don't. Yes, I know Pacino's slumming it. Just don't.
I'm making a movie tomorrow, John.
I needed money for King Lear.
Hang on. So the idea would have been that, you know, he pulls over Pacino, and Pacino's, like, 17-year-old girlfriend. That would have been amazing.
I'm making a movie tomorrow. I'm considering Steve McQueen, Lee Marvin.
I call it the Dead Dozen.
Okay, I only watched the trailer for this, but even in the trailer, Aidan Gillen keeps slipping into an Irish accent. Was that a problem throughout the movie?
Yes, it was. It was a big problem. And I'm going to spoil it for people out there, because honestly, nobody in their right mind cares for 12 rounds. The end of the movie has John Cena and Aidan Gillen in a fist fight on a helicopter.
Yeah.
So you've got Aidan Gillen, who weighs 70 pounds, fighting John Cena, whose bicep weighs 70 pounds.
So this is actually less plausible than Lithgow versus Stallone.
Oh, yeah.
At least Lithgow had 3 feet of height on Stallone.
At least Lithgow had that crazy inner city shop teacher background, you know, that he could draw on. Because that's what he looks like. He looks like a shop teacher from the inner city.
And he has that great chin, too.
One of those shop teachers who's forced to retire early after certain rumors start to float around.
Yeah.
Like, this had the opportunity to be the single most one-sided villain hero fight since Out for Justice. Right? But no, they actually get into a fist fight, and then a bomb is activated on the helicopter, and Cena and his girlfriend, who is flying the helicopter...
What?
Don't even ask me to explain this. Is piloting the helicopter, jump out, and the helicopter stays there in midair hovering for about 20 seconds before it explodes.
That's what helicopters do. I play video games.
Yes.
You know how hard it is to fly a helicopter? I've heard it described as standing on a basketball.
Nah, it's really easy. Trust me. I played SimCopter.
Guys, I've put so much time into Black Ops. I know all about helicopters. it's terrible.
All right, Steve, what's your ugly?
My ugly is...
What year did it come?
Did you go on the Facebook and check?
Yes, I know exactly what movie it was. It's that
2006.
Maybe it was 2006. It was this like GQ / Guess Jeans / Gap ad that stared at a bunch of teen models and was about witches.
You're not gonna make any of us your weeotch, are you?
don't forget the incredibly topical soundtrack featuring White Zombie in 2000.
Yes. It's one of those movies where it's just like, no teenager ever listens to this ever.
The Covenant, or as I like, the pilot for the WB's Supernatural.
It is notable because it's terrible. The period where they're still genetically engineering Taylor Lautner.
Oh man, you should buy a copy of that on Blu-ray so whenever Larry starts up about Supernatural, you have something to throw at him.
It was a terrible movie. It was,
oh yeah.
More human than human.
It's like The Craft, but worse.
It's like The Craft. Oh. I apologize.
Shut up, Ford Fairlane. You're not funny. But yeah, The Covenant was just... What the hell was even going on in this movie, man?
I don't know.
You know, like, okay, I'm watching a bunch of guys who look like they should be in a One Direction video, but it's 2000.
Oh, and they're witches. Guy witches.
Man, if I had only seen Taylor Kitsch in this, I would never have guessed that he could have played John Carter.
I would never have guessed that he could have been so badass.
Yeah.
You know? It was such a horrible movie.
I haven't seen it for a few years. I take it he was a wiener.
Everybody in the
movie. He was like ripped for a teen, but he did like... At the point where Laura came in while I was watching it and he was lying in a hospital bed, she said, "Is that a girl or a boy?"
is this gay porn and do you have something you want to tell me?
Yeah, it's kind of a more erotic.
It's like
Teen Beat, Tiger Beat, one of those.
Yeah.
But like, it's like if one of those posters was a movie, it would be this.
I would say Stephanie Meyer watched it over and over and over again while reading Anne Rice novels before she wrote Twilight.
It's like a Calvin Klein ad, basically, but as a movie.
Yep.
Would you want to know something shocking?
This is the most egregious waste of Stephen McHattie I've ever seen. Ever. I had no idea he was in the movie.
Is Stephen McHattie the Spartan Lincoln from 300?
He's in 300.
He's got a Lincoln beard.
Yeah.
The old man with the six-pack.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's him.
Yes.
Yeah. Fucking awesome in Watchmen.
He's an amazing actor, and he's under, like, 6 inches of latex in this.
And he's also in Beverly Hills Cop 3, so that's... Which one do you think he regrets more on his resume?
I don't think he regrets anything on his resume.
Well, he
lives comfortably.
The Covenant actually made money. So.
Oh, it did, yeah. When it came out, when we got it in at the store, it was shortly after we took over the Jumbo Video location, and it rented like crazy.
Mm-hmm. And it's really, really weird to see. I think most of the movie was shot in Quebec, and then there's like one scene where all of a sudden you're on the waterfront in Lunenburg. It's just like, that's not the same place.
It's horrible.
Yeah, just, you know, it's a bad movie.
And it's worth telling people, by the way, the Weotch line, that's from the movie.
Yeah, it is. Wasn't there another really bad one, too?
Another?
There's a few.
But wasn't there a really horrible, like, one-liner, witch-based kind of, I'm trying to remember?
Oh, probably.
I'm on IMDb looking up the quotes right now.
Well,
I cracked my head like a hard-boiled egg and stuck it in a bowl of bleach after I watched this, so.
Well,
come to save little Miss Muffet, have we?
Yes!
That was the one! That was the one!
That's the one!
You're too late. A spider came and sat down beside her and frightened Miss Muffet. That's not even clever.
No, and you're also not reading it with the, like, crazy amount of terrible, I don't want to call it acting.
Harry Potter can kiss my ass. This is gold.
What the hell?
This is better than Shane Black.
That thing between your legs. It's like a penis, but smaller. Oh, this is horrible.
When a teacher mentions Stephen King, somebody replies, yeah, Dreamcatcher was the shit.
Yeah. Well, while we're talking about terrible one-liners, I'll go to my ugly, and of course I'm talking about Nightmare on Elm Street 4,
woo!
The Dream Master.
Mm-hmm.
This is the point where all the Nightmare franchise was about was having Freddy killing people in inventive ways and saying one-liners, and it's not even scary anymore, and nothing in the movie makes sense.
And unlike the one prior, it's not even so 1980s that it's amazing.
No.
Is this the one that had the comic book character coming to life? And
No, that was number 5.
Oh, okay.
This is the one where this girl, she gets killed, like, while weightlifting.
Yeah.
And the main character, she goes into the movie. It's pretty terrible. Of course, since it's Harlan, it does look great. The only things that save it from being a total shitfest is the fact that it looks good, and the fact that the main actress is pretty decent.
But man, it feels like you're watching a spaghetti western with the way the audio is looped.
And
I can't believe Brian Helgeland wrote this movie. I also can't believe Brian Helgeland got work after writing this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With lines like, swish, kill the fish.
Wow.
It's also got, like, the
picture that coming out of Robert Englund's voice that sounds like he just had a stroke.
That's not even a Freddy line. That's the worst thing.
Oh, because it sounds like a Freddy line.
Well, here's a Freddy line. Somebody says Kruger, and he says, well, it ain't Dr. Seuss.
Wow. Well,
it ain't Dr. Seuss.
Or he kills this guy in the waterbed, and his one-liner is, how's this for a wet dream?
I'm gonna go sell my Nightmare on Elm Street box set now.
Jesus.
I don't
need it.
Yeah, and it's got the worst. I think I don't remember the one in Freddy 6, which of course is the worst Freddy. But besides that, it's got the worst Freddy death. She reflects Freddy in a mirror
and reads him a nursery rhyme.
Yeah, and that's how he dies.
What the fuck?
Yeah, it's
He's like Superman. They got to invent ways to hurt him.
I'm so glad I didn't go back and rewatch this movie.
Here's one of my favorite lines. This this black girl. I think it's a black girl. The main character's. No, it's the girl who works out. She's like, I don't work out 4 hours every day to let some night stalker beat me.
You accidentally read that too convincingly.
One of the funny things too is most of the movie is actually, there's nothing going on in the real world. Like, there's some lip service to pay to, like, their parents not believing them or anything. But it's all in the dream world, and, there's so much horrible stuff, like, this dog peeing flame.
That was my, like, one of the few parts I liked. It's like, hey, that's kind of cool. But, yeah.
The only scene I'll give it credit for is a scene where, the girl, she gets in the car, she drives away, and then gets out and runs, and then she's back to getting to the car. Like, it's like a loop. That was like the only clever, interesting thing in the movie.
Unfortunately, it did force us to watch the same scene in the movie 3 times, which is just not good. Yeah.
Which one had the claws coming up out of the water like a shark fin?
That's this one.
Yeah. And then they come to the beach or whatever, and they just keep moving up the sand and.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like when you go into a really bad haunted house. like where it's not scary, but everything in it is kind of looks cool.
It's like you're watching a really bad sequel in a franchise that should have punched its ticket like two movies earlier.
It's like the music video at the beginning of the Deadpool.
Oh, brutal!
Why did you have to sully Jim Carrey like that? He was trying, goddammit.
But yeah, I think that rounds up our good, bad, and ugly. So let's go with final thoughts on Rennie Harlan.
He has a great eye and he's really good at filming action, but I kind of think he doesn't have enough storytelling chops to be able to do it on his own, to really sense where the weaknesses are in a bad script. And so if he's given a really good script, he can do amazing stuff with it, or he can do amazing stuff in spite of a bad script and come up with sort of a mixture of a picture, but
Exorcist is the beginning.
Yeah.
I think Harlan,
but I like the guy.
I think he's an effective director, and I think, like, in the camp of, you know, I call it the second generation, you know, your first generation, you had guys like McTiernan and Donner and, like, all of these, like, these big early 80s action guys, Walter Hill. I think he's really one of the second generation guys. He had that little bridge period between him and, like, the Bruckheimer boys, like when Michael Bay and Simon West and all these guys came in. I think he's clearly more talented. He's more of, like, he's more capable of filming an action sequence and structuring a film and really tightening things up in editing than, like, a lot of the Bruckheimer boys are. Like, a lot of you know, I call them the 21st century action directors. He's the last of the old guard, you know. He falls into that late generation of the old guard before, you know, like John Woo's eccentric visuals and slow-mo came in and took over. Or you had, like, Robert Rodriguez with the Peckinpah, Rodriguez and Tarantino bringing back the Sam Peckinpah stuff. And, like all of these guys coming in and adding their own little signature styles to everything. He was, like, the last of the real textbook action directors.
Yeah.
And to me, he's not as good as McTiernan, but he's better than Jonathan Mostow.
Yes. So, and you know, like, and he does definitely have sensibilities and stuff that, you know, he's capable of turning out work of equal, like, visual fidelity and quality to someone like Donner or McTiernan. But he's more of a hired gun than they are. Like, I don't think he puts as much of himself into the film. Like, he doesn't really put forth the effort that they do. I think he's a great textbook director, fantastic textbook director. And I think when he gets something that he feels passionately about, like, say, The Long Kiss Goodnight, Cutthroat Island, Die Hard 2, you know, Die Hard 2, this was his shot. This was his ticket to the big time. And you can tell he really threw it all in there, you know, like all his chips were on the table. And I think,
and he's got fabulous hair.
And he's got fabulous. I mean, he looks like
he's finished Jesus.
Yeah, he looks like he should be referred to as Thorgrim Doomhammer, and he should be fronting like a finished death metal band or something. You know, one of those bands.
You want the Odinson to direct your picture.
Yeah.
And one thing too is that the consecutive failure of Cutthroat Island and then like Driven a few years later really put him down.
It really hurt him, and it's not fair because, you know, both of those films, Cutthroat Island and Driven, both had their moments. Both of those movies were pretty competent flicks. Driven is, I know Driven nowadays doesn't really have any kind of a reputation, but it came out around the same time or close on, like, Fast and the Furious and stuff like that, so it kind of, that really, like, the success of the Fast and the Furious really kind of overshadowed it. And it's a different kind of movie. It's more akin to Days of Thunder. It's more that style of a... But even again, you know, it's got Stallone, who co-wrote and produced it. And
yeah.
It does have a bit more of that Rocky vibe to it. Like, it is more of a heartfelt story than The Fast and the Furious or Days of Thunder or one of those. You know, and it wasn't a horrible flick. Driven wasn't a bad movie. There were some choices made with the racing sequences, like they used CG for some of the racing sequences that looked really cheesy. But, I mean, there was no other way they could have really pulled it off without crashing multi-million-dollar race cars. And that's dangerous, you know?
But and then, of course, he had to pick up the Exorcist, which was doomed to fail anyways.
Well, I mean, you know, you're looking at a film, the last sequel was made in, what, 1989? So,
yeah.
You know, you can't meet experts.
And the studio specifically hired you to make a schlocky movie.
Yeah. They wanted... they hired you to come in and bloody it up a little bit because Schrader's version was too cerebral. You know, like, that in and of itself pretty much tells you that you're working on a project that's doomed to failure. You're cashing a paycheck, you know? And Harlan, like, he does do a lot of paycheck work, but at the same time, I think, like, if he could find something that got him hungry again, you know, if he could find something that he really believed in and was given...
Shane Black!
No, Shane's a director now. He can't save anyone anymore.
That's right. But, I mean, given the resources and, like, a good cast and stuff like that, I think Harlan could really... Yeah, I think he could really bring it. I think he's still fat.
Like, can you imagine him doing one of the new superhero flicks?
I think it'd be absolutely freaking gobsmacking. I think it'd be amazing.
I think Harlan is a great hired gun.
Yep.
And I think, unfortunately, that string of bombs he had in the late 90s kind of...
It hurt him.
Yeah, I mean, Hollywood's a fickle bitch.
Yeah.
And, I mean, yeah, it lowered his stock, and he's not getting the... not getting the offers, you know, to come on and take a property and make it visually appealing.
Yeah, and I mean,
but yeah, if we're gonna give Joe Johnson Captain America, there's no reason Rennie Harlan can't do a superhero movie.
Yeah,
to me, there was absolutely no reason whatsoever Rennie Harlan couldn't have been the director of The Expendables 2.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
Right,
and I think he would have. I mean, not to diss Simon West. Simon West did a pretty capable job on The Expendables 2, but Harlan could have knocked that shit out of the park.
Especially this coming from someone like me who really longs for an action movie to feel like it used to feel.
Yeah.
And he's friends with Stallone, too. I mean...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, every now and again you see these little flashes. Like, every now and again you'll see a film that come out that does kind of harken back to the 80s action movies and stuff. It does have that little flash. But, you know, like, I haven't seen anything really nail it, and I think Harlan could be the one to do it. Harlan really could be the one to resurrect it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And besides, if you're doing an action movie, it's supposed to feel like that. It could never hurt having from the director of Die Hard 2.
Yeah.
From the director of Die Hard 2 and The Long Kiss Goodnight, or Die Hard 2 and Cliffhanger, you know?
So, and something I'll give to him, too, is that most of his movies, despite the scenaristic lackings, they're fun to watch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, like, they do look really good. But with that, I guess we've seen everything we had to say about Rennie Harlan.
I'll add one last thought.
Yeah?
There's one thing you can't call his movies is ponderous or tedious. You know?
Yeah.
He always has a high energy.
Well, The Covenant.
Okay. Well, even that moved like stink. Thank you.
All right.
I'm withholding any further comments about Mindhunters.
I guess, Steve, you're up next. So who's your choice for next week?
Next week we will be tackling another European crazy person. Probably more crazy than
another tall Nordic.
I mean, you know, I go back to Harlan, and what I always... My favorite image of Harlan is from the behind-the-scenes footage on Die Hard 2 when they're filming the big attack sequence on the church. And, you know, there are explosions going off everywhere, and there's squibs being fired everywhere, there's machine guns being shot everywhere, there's skidoos racing around. And he's just sitting behind the control console, and he's going, "Wow, isn't this really interesting?"
I always love the shot of Harlan. Harlan plays one of the students in Nightmare 4.
He does.
Yeah.
And you've got all the... class are standing there, and then in the back of the classroom there's this 7 foot tall guy, blonde dude with a big beard, sitting down in the back of the room.
Well, our next director is the polar opposite. He wouldn't be sitting at a table going, "Wow, isn't this interesting?" He would be jumping and yelling and screaming and hollering and
"I am the bug!"
and basically
shooting a gun in the air
out of the actors. We're going to be talking about if squibs have a name, it must be Paul Verhoeven.
Also boobs. And never forget boobs.
So lots of squibs, lots of boobs.
Three boobs.
Be sure to tune in for that one. That's going to be fun. I guess until then, all we can say is...
see you next Wednesday.